Welcome to the From the Heart podcast presented by the First Bank Center for Family-Owned Businesses. My name is Ed Hart, and this is episode number 97. And I think originally it was going to be about 85, then it was going to be 91, then it was going to be 93. We've made it to 97. We got in under the century mark. My guest today is my dear, dear friend, Julie Hudash. Julie is the founder and CEO of a nonprofit board that I have the good fortune of sitting on, and that's Team Kids. We're going to hear a lot about Team Kids, so I'm not going to tell you that much about it in the intro, but I've known Julie for a couple of years, and you know, some friendships you have take years to evolve and take, you know, years and years. And we went to high school together. We went to college together. We've known each other 30 years and we're finally close. Julie and I have become fast friends and fast, just really, really close, best of friends. And I'm just excited, Julie, to get this time with you today. So welcome to the From the Heart podcast. It's good to finally have you on recording and to document this conversation and this friendship for all time here. How you doing?
I'm so excited to be here, and there's no one I can think of that I'd rather hang out with and talk about the great things going on in the world with than you, Ed.
Well, it's good to see you, Julie. And I usually, what I do at the beginning of a podcast is I'll tell a little bit about my guest, and I'll do research on their website or talk to them. She has just this amazing about me profile on LinkedIn, and I'm going to put my reading glasses on, as us old guys have to do sometimes. And I'm just going to read to you what she wrote on her profile, and then we'll just jump into a great conversation today. So from her profile, she says, "I am so lucky to be living my dream. I have the great fortune to serve as the founder and CEO of Team Kids, a nonprofit delivering empirically validated youth development school programs in California, Arizona, Virginia, and New York. My dream is to ensure that every child knows they matter, they are significant, and that their community needs them as capable leaders. Youth show up in this world with a wide open window of compassion." I get emotional when I read this, knowing that these are your words about you and how well I know you. I'm going to read that last sentence again. "Youth show up in this world with a wide open window of compassion and with big dreams to make our world a better and more equitable place for all. Whether it's to help endangered animals, to find a cure for cancer, or to end homelessness, I believe it's our most privileged responsibility to ensure that our future leaders, social entrepreneurs, and philanthropists have the support, experiences, and mentors they need to make their biggest dreams come true." I love that. I think that we could just focus on all of that right there, and we probably will in some roundabout way. All right, so let's just start where it started. 2001, right around the World Trade Center is coming down, right around, you know, arguably the most significant event in world history, at least on U.S. soil, has happened. You get this idea, and I know it didn't just happen overnight, but talk, Julie, a little bit about just the impetus behind the launch of what is now known as Team Kids.
Well, you know, it's just throughout my life, I felt like such a calling to make a difference with young people. I always joke I was a youth advocate when I was a kid. Even when I was a kid, I stuck up for kids. And all throughout my, you know, adult years, and when I got married and started a family, I just kept trying to think, like, what am I supposed to be doing to help kids? And I went to grad school for a while and figured, you know, they'd give me my treasure map. Like, Julie, this is what you do with your life. Go here, turn left, take this. And in fact, that I didn't find that I found those answers. And so in 2001, in March, I decided to just start with my own kids in our kids' school at Vista Verde Elementary in Irvine, trying to find a way for our kids and their friends to know that they're powerful, to know that they matter. Like I said, I always say that they matter, that they're significant. The truth is, in our country, you know, kids don't have money, they don't vote, and so they're not really valued, to be honest with you. The Search Institute has interviewed over 8 million kids since the 80s, and about 1 in 4 children in America feel like they're a resource or that people think that they can contribute. Well, that's the only place that we get adults, folks. So, like, right. We need to do a better job.
And so it was the really adult factory. Yeah,
right. A way for my own kids to have empathy and know that they could affect change and stick up for what they believe in. And so we were starting our first program. It was called Kids Helping Kids before it was Team Kids.
Yeah.
And we were going to spend a whole month with the school. I had an assembly plan, the whole school, kindergarten through eighth grade, learning about those that are experiencing hunger and homelessness. So we were going to spend a whole week bringing in toys, a whole week bringing in food and clothes and books. And right before the kickoff, I saw this article in the newspaper of this beautiful little boy. He looked like the little boy from Jerry Maguire, little three-year-old boy with glasses and little ringlets. And he had one of the rarest heart defects. I think there were only five children at that time that had been diagnosed with something this rare. And the Orange County Fire Authorities were racing there like twice a week and literally shocking his little heart back to beating. So he was dying a few times a week. So right before I was launching Kids Helping Kids, I saw this newspaper article with this fire captain, Steve McHale, and Jim Cass, the paramedic at Orange County Fire Authority. And I thought, wow, we're starting Kids Helping Kids. And they needed money to be raised to get this little boy medevaced to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. So the insurance would pay for the heart surgery, but not the medevac, which is over $20,000 for this young family. And they didn't have the money. And so I'm gonna make the story a little bit shorter for sake of time, but I brought that story to my kids and their friends. And I have just never in my life seen manifested power at any age, at any time in my life. These young people, the kids were all like 8, 9, 10. Mm-hmm. And they just said, we're going to save his life. And they were like, we're going to have car washes and we're going to raise money. And I just was like, okay, maybe we bit off a little more than we could chew, right, you know, in terms of capacity. And the truth is Jeremy could have died any day. So it was a bit of a risk getting hundreds of kids involved in a situation that was so serious. And sort of just to kind of squeeze together what happened, these kids, I called Captain Steve at the fire station. I said, I saw your picture in the paper and I have hundreds of kids that want to raise money. And Captain Steve was definitely kind of like,
sure, okay.
Yeah. Curious. What kids are going to give me a bunch of pocket change? Like, this little boy's dying. So he kind of put me off. He said the right things, but I could tell by the tone of his voice.
Yeah.
He was kind of like, that's really cute, but we don't have time for the kids for this. And the kids had raised money from their parents. They had, like I said, popsicle sales. They went door to door. And a couple of weeks later, I called that Captain Steve back and I said, hey, the kids have raised like $3,000 and they want to have a pancake breakfast with the fire department. Mm-hmm. And Captain Steve, I could hear him kind of laugh at himself because the kids had raised more money than the fire department had.
That's awesome.
And he was like, okay, we're in. So we had a pancake breakfast with Orange County Fire Authority. And we had the Orange County Register reporters there and LA Times Register reporters there back when we actually had reporters. Right. They came out with little notepads, right? Yep. And covered stories. And they wrote the most beautiful stories in the paper. It was about Jeremy and his rare heart defect, but it was about these amazing kids who were so committed to saving the life of a little boy. And I remember one of the reporters asked Matthew Copley, who was about 8, and she said, you know, what if it's impossible? You know, what if it's impossible to raise enough money to save this little boy? And he looked right at her in the eyes and he said, impossible just means you didn't try hard enough. Yeah. And I remember the reporter looking at me going like, I don't know what you're doing over here.
What's anyway, in the Kool-Aid or the lemonade? What are you feeding these? Yeah. What are they drinking?
Yeah. So anyways, just to wrap up the story, the LA Times and the Register reporters were out and we got a donation from a German businessman who picked up an LA Times at LAX and sent a check to help start this organization to reach more kids. And then Captain Steve, my big naysayer, he got a call from a famous celebrity in Hollywood who had read the LA Times and he said, how much do you need to get this little boy to the Mayo Clinic? And he told him how much, and we were about $18,000 shy. And he said, as long as it remains anonymous, I want to help. And the very next day we had an $18,000 cashier check in the fire station mailbox.
Wow.
Then that was in the paper. And then a gentleman actually contacted us and donated his jet, his pilot, his fuel, and flew Jeremy and the paramedic. And so the good news is Jeremy's 26 years old today, continues to inspire everyone he meets. Captain Steve, my naysayer, is my founding board president. Huh. And those founding kids have all picked, you know, career paths around service. Many of them have and still work for Team Kids. And so that founding, you know, story, it was, you know, if you believe in the universe, if you believe in God, if you believe whatever, it was just, I think it was just meant to happen to save Jeremy's life and also to put this mission on the map that like don't overlook young people, because this powerful fire captain didn't think they can help. And in fact, Jeremy is here today. His mom told us that Jeremy would probably not be alive today if it wasn't for a bunch of 8 to 10 and 11 year olds. And so that was our founding story in 2001, and this great partnership with police and fire. And then when 9/11 hit, that just solidified. That was just, we were founded in March, just before September, when September 11th hit. So those partnerships were proven, and just got deeper from there.
I love that story. I've heard it before because I get to serve with you on Team Kids, but to hear you share that story, many people hearing it today for the first time. If you allowed yourself 23 years ago, and maybe you didn't, I know a lot of business owners I talk to don't think 23 years out, but if you just went back 23 years and thought about what Team Kids would look like today, where is it today compared to where you thought it might be back in that initial time frame?
Well, I would love to say it's bigger than I dreamed it was, but I'm a social entrepreneur, and I want every kid in our country to know how important they are. And so I would say we're on the cusp now of becoming a national model, but even back then, I probably would have wished it was even reaching more kids than the 20 to 30,000 kids we reach a year, every school year in 9 months. But now we know the model, you know, we know police, fire, school district, we have the research, which I'm sure we'll be able to touch on. So I feel like the scaling is going to be a lot faster. I sometimes get impatient because I know the research is there. I know kids are sitting in our schools just waiting for someone to believe in them. And so fast enough is never fast enough for me.
Talk about the name Team Kids. So you said Kids Helping Kids evolved into Team Kids. How was that transition, and how did that come about?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. Team Kids Helping Kids, I love the name. And it was owned by like a t-shirt company in New York. So we couldn't trademark the name, and we couldn't get the website. And so my son, who's now, he's 32 years old. He's one of the founding Team Kids, and he's a sheriff deputy in Texas. And we sat at my house on this, you know, computer with probably dial-up, you know, AOL dial-up. And we were just searching names that really, really captured like what the mission is about. And really, Team Kids, it's a team of kids, but it's also a team of educators, business leaders, police officers, firefighters, to really put kids in the lead. And so it was Kids Helping Kids for a few years, and then we incorporated over to Team Kids. Our tagline is empowering America's future. So it's Team Kids empowering America's future.
Yeah. And we're going to put your logo in the notes on here. Talk about those kids that are in the logo.
That's another funny story. But in our logo, there's five little graphics of kids. There's three boys and two girls. And when we first did our logo, I had several different versions that our graphic designer was saying, hey, which one do you like? And I like this version the best. But I said, I feel like there's too many of the kids in there. They kind of look like ants. Maybe take a few of the kids out. And my graphic designer just kept staring at me. And I thought, what did I miss? And she was like, Julie, those are your children. And I was like, don't take any of them out.
Leave them right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So our five kids are in the logo. And I often have been told that Team Kids is like a family business. And it really is. It's a nonprofit, but it's our family legacy. So my oldest daughter, Lauren, and Jonathan, they were part of that first group of kids out playing hockey that saw that picture of Jeremy and wanted to save his life. And it's been a hallmark of all five of our kids growing up, helping this organization grow. So it's pretty exciting.
This is a hard interview for me to do only for one reason. I know so much about you and about the history that I want to ask questions because I want the audience. And I know a lot of people who are going to listen to this interview know you as well, but I want to ask questions that people won't know. Sorry, somebody keeps popping up on my chat on my Microsoft Teams and I have to keep closing it. So anybody's hearing a little beeping sound in the recording, that's what it is. I'll try to keep that from happening. Let me take us back just a little bit prior to Team Kids and prior, you know, back to your teenager, your early 20s. You were an athlete at USC. You were a Division I track athlete. Talk about how that experience prepared you for the success that you've had in this launch of Team Kids and just in life, that discipline and that work ethic that you obviously had to have to be a D1 athlete to convert that into your career.
I mean, I think that was a pivotal time in my life that really did create who I am today. I ran the mile, so it's a long, arduous race. It gets faster and faster, so the point where you just feel like you're sprinting for a mile. I think personally, it just made me really resilient. You know, I think probably my most powerful characteristic in why Team Kids made it 23 years is perseverance. You know, I just don't quit when things are hard. I don't quit when I pay, you know, years ago when I would pay my staff and not myself. But being an athlete, I actually ran cross country, which I did not like at all, but it was part of my scholarship. And then I ran indoor track and outdoor track. So I competed all year long, only went to a few USC football games because I was too busy. But it taught me so much. Like I can perform when I don't feel well. I know how to like deal with pressure. There's just so much as a Division I athlete. We get on a plane and go to the Drake Relays. We're gone for 4 days, miss 2 days of school. You're back. You have finals. And unlike other sports, we don't have our own, like, well, we do have tutors, but it was just a lot to juggle and perform. So that taught me that personally. But professionally, it was my first experience really witnessing just the tragic inequities in education. So I grew up in Irvine, very blessed. New books and not a shortage of resources. And so as an athlete at USC, we used to go out and talk to kids in South Central LA. So I had the experience a few times, but one time in particular that just changed me forever. And I was with USC football players and basketball players. And I was the only track athlete that went. And we went into school in South Central LA. And I was just shocked by what I saw about the kids sharing books and old books and just the lack of resources. And I had never, I knew that there was a lot of inequity. And being in a track team, being on a track team, I had dear friends that were very diverse. I had two sprinters who are Black that were roommates. I just grew up in that diverse neighborhood, or team, but I hadn't seen kids in that setting. And being kind of a skinny white miler, the kids were not that, they were not that interested in me. They were interested in the football players and the basketball players. And I just remember sitting watching these athletes talk to the kids about how they could go to USC and be an athlete and how important it was to do well at school. And I just remember looking at the kids and how excited they were to just have someone see them and hear their ideas all competing with their hands up, and to just know like someone believed in them, you know. And I think it left a really indelible mark on me forever of just how important it is for kids to meet heroes and for kids to feel safe, but also feel that people believe in them. And it was just, it changed me. I worked at a teenage runaway shelter for girls. After that, my husband worked for Coca-Cola for many years. So we lived in, we lived in Colorado and we lived in St. Louis and we lived in Des Moines, Iowa. But I worked at a teenage runaway shelter for girls in St. Louis. And it just broke my heart just to see so many kids that didn't feel any hope, that felt like they didn't have anywhere to go. And that's when I kind of pivoted out of my master's really in more social work, because I wanted to bring them all home. I couldn't, I come home and cry. And then I started learning research about developmentally. How can we help kids feel safe earlier? How can we help kids feel more positive about their future so that they're more engaged and do well in other areas of their life? And so that's kind of what led me to Team Kids and where we are today.
Have you seen, I'm sure you have, are there any stories that come to mind where you see that transition in some of the kids? You know, a couple hundred thousand kids have gone through the program. I don't know the exact number. I hear 250,000. Any stories come to mind where you saw that transition in any children where they didn't, you felt like those same kids you saw in South Central when you were at SC, that maybe they didn't have any feeling of hope and then they came through this program and now success stories that have come as a result?
So many. Yeah. Awesome. I wish we could have hours, but one comes to mind, and it was a young man who came to Team Kids by way of not our Team Kids Challenge, which is our traditional program. And a lot of those kids, whether we're teaching in Harlem or Compton or Irvine or Palos Verdes, I have stories. But one particular young man came to me because he had court ordered community service. And a deputy DA asked if he could do a service with Team Kids. And I was like, absolutely. Not necessarily in our schools, but I have projects. I had like, what a privilege to get a chance to work with him. And I shared with him, like, we're not cutting any corners. These are the hours. And I had a chance to be with him and ask him, like, you're not defined by this, the worst decision you made as a 16-year-old. Like, where do you see yourself? What are you passionate about? What do you want to do? What kind of person do you want to be? And I could just see his eyes light up, because I think people really judged him by some of the actions that he took. And it just got the spark about him again. And he didn't really have parents that were engaged. And so I actually went to juvenile court with him. I ended up, you know, getting a chance to be an advocate for him. And after the program, all his hours were done. He stayed and volunteered with Team Kids for like another year. And he's doing very well. But he told me, he said, you know, this was the first time I felt good about myself. And it's the first time I felt like I was part of something good. So again, most of our kids aren't coming to Team Kids by that direction. But a lot of them just, they have a chance to learn in our school program to like see themselves as something bigger than maybe others make them feel.
You know, it's fun. Every now and then I run into somebody that knows of Team Kids, not through the traditional means, not through like our board or someone they know, but a good friend of mine is a teacher in Fullerton. And she is at a school that is a Team Kids school. She goes on and on about Team Kids and the transitions that she's seen in kids when they come together and they do these projects together. Talk a little bit about Team Kids Challenge and how that works in schools. Anybody that is interested, later in the interview, I'm going to ask, you know, how to get involved and how can people reach out to you, but maybe you can kind of touch a little bit on that as well. If people listening today have children in elementary school, how they can get more engaged and how that program works.
Yeah. So the Teen Kids Challenge is our flagship program. It is unlike any program taught in the United States, or probably the world, if it's not in the United States. And it's almost like this boot camp for leadership, service, and confidence. It's a 5-week program it's an all school intervention. So we actually teach in the school during the day. It's not an after school program. It's a during school program. And before I kind of share what the program looks like, I will share just the innovative, like non-traditional delivery of our partnership. So we actually train on-duty police officers and firefighters as Team Kids mentors. And they join us in the school to teach this 5-week program. So I just don't think that if we empower kids to be leaders, but we don't change communities, then kids come out and they think they're so strong and have these great dreams. But if we don't change the way police, fire, you know, the community views young people in terms of potential, then it's almost doing a disservice to kids, right? Yeah. Because then they feel empowered and then they hit a brick wall. And so because of Jeremy, because of 9/11, and because of our partnerships, we had an opportunity to do something really unique after our kickoff. And I was really blessed to have two of the most amazing chiefs, Irvine Police Chief Dave Maggard back many, many years ago, and Orange County Fire Authority Division Chief Matt Vidala was a fire chief in Irvine. And both are probably still to this day, my most powerful mentors in my life. They both saw how they could help kids in a non-traditional way. Right. So from a police chief, it's like, we got to go out and catch bad guys. Well, Dave Maggard was like, you know, if we go out and mentor and we support young people, maybe we won't show up at that DUI in a few years. And so I was really blessed at the beginning. And this is kind of important in terms of what the program looks like, to have Dr. Gene Milan at Vista Verde and this amazing police and fire chief who came together and said, let's make this happen. But to make it happen, this is what it would need to be for a police department or a fire department or a school district. And I think it's probably the single most powerful reason Team Kids is where it is today, is because with Dr. Milan, she said, we can't use teachable minutes. Like, we got to figure out how to do this with lunch recesses. And Chief Maggard's like, I want my officers there, but they can't be there for a long time. If they're there, I want them having impact on kids and getting back. Like, they can't be doing administrative stuff. And so I luckily had all these key pieces in my first program to say, okay, we do all the administrative lifting. We'll do all the hard work. We just need you guys to come and
show up,
be a mentor for kids and get back to work.
Yeah.
So the program is 5 weeks. It's called the Team Kids Challenge. It's amazing. It's very similar to what it was 23 years ago. It's gone through some iterations, but I think we did a really good job at the beginning. It starts with like book it. It has bookends. It starts with a kickoff assembly, which is the entire school. So sometimes we'll do two or three assemblies. And we have our uniformed police and firefighters on stage. The most powerful part of the assembly is we show this video called Our Dream Piece, and hopefully we'll share that with anyone watching. But we ask kids, if you had a magic wand and you could change anything in the world, you know, what would you change? And then we invite kids up on stage and they share about, you know, I would change the way racism is, because it shouldn't matter what color your skin is. Everyone should have the same chances. Or I would stop cutting down trees because we're running out of oxygen. Or they're just amazing. We had a student actually a couple of weeks ago who brought up human trafficking. 10 years old. So the awareness of kids is so powerful. So they talk about the dreams and how they would change the world. Then this program empowers every single kid, kindergarten through sixth or eighth grade. Every week they learn about a different weekly charity. So bringing in food for the hungry or blankets and towels for the animal shelter. The whole school learns about a different issue in their community each week. And they're challenged to a goal to make a difference for the charity, their community, helping the hungry or animals or kids in the hospital. But the magic of the program is our leadership team. And that's the oldest two grades of the school. And at the kickoff, they're invited to be the leaders of their school. And they volunteer to give up their lunch recess at least once a week for a month to meet in the multipurpose room, instead of playing basketball on the court, instead of doing what they would normally do, to serve as the leaders of their school and to be the leaders of this program for 5 weeks. And so my team, our team kids coaches, our teachers, and our police and firefighters meet with those older students 4 to 5 weeks in a row. And that's where the magic is, because we're trying to get this inoculation of empowerment before middle school, where so many high-risk behaviors start. And so we go back to that dream piece. The kids brainstorm like 25 issues of how they would change the world. And it's gang violence. We teach in Harlem and Brooklyn. I had a 10-year-old girl and she had a magic wand. She would stop raping. That's what a 10-year-old girl said. These are the issues in some of our communities that are so
sad that these kids are aware of these types of issues, for sure. But yeah, they want to do something about it is heartwarming.
But they vote on one issue. So they agree democratically, we'll vote on one issue. So maybe it's helping kids that have cancer. And then that group over the 4 weeks, they learn, what is a business? What is an entrepreneur? What does the word philanthropist mean? What is a philanthropist? So our coaches are like, you're all going to start businesses. You're going to be entrepreneurs and you're going to be philanthropists. So throughout the 4 weeks, the kids get in a small group. They actually get a business plan and they come up with this fun carnival game. Anything from like human whack-a-mole in a refrigerator box. They come up with such creative businesses. And then they host a school-wide carnival with all the school. They sell tickets for five for a dollar. The police and fire come and they raise money, and every single penny they raise, which could be anywhere from $200 to $3,000, depending on every penny, Team Kids doesn't take a penny of it, goes to the charity and issue that they voted as philanthropists. Hmm. And then their last meeting, we have a representative from that charity come out and thank the kids. And the kids give a big check, oversized check. And you can hear a pin drop because the kids work really hard. They learn how to start businesses. And so that's our flagship program. And we're just, it creates a dual paradigm shift in how we view kids, how police and fire and teachers, how we can show up and suit up and be better advocates for kids. Because I think it's kind of time to turn the tables a little bit, because we all think we need to teach kids so much, but I hate to break it, but I think we have a whole heck of a lot more to learn from our kids.
Yeah, the wisdom in these young generations is unbelievable, and what they can teach us if we'll just stop and listen to them a little bit, that's for sure. You've probably seen some pretty tremendous stories of some of these kids who were fifth and sixth grade leaders in the schools and now what they're out doing in society. Any come to mind there?
Yeah, I think of, my own kids who are all kind of working for Team Kids, but I think of Jenna Walmsley, who she was my oldest daughter, Lauren's best friend, and really a catalyst in wanting this pancake breakfast. And she's incredible. She served through Team Kids. She actually was one of the kids that started our Team Kids Youth Council, our high school program, because they didn't want it to end. but she served all through Team Kids and college. And today she's an area director with Young Life, which is a Christian organization mentoring kids in really high-risk areas. And I've seen her move up through the ranks and just share her heart for kids that are really struggling, teens, you know, that are in foster care, girls that are pregnant, and really creating a safe place for them as she's really worked to counsel them. Another one of our founding kids is an occupational therapist. One of them is works for me as our director of operations. Another one's a police officer. So I think what happens is we all want to matter. We get that spark when we know, like, what I did made this person's life better. And I think developmentally, what I think the magic is, if we don't give kids developmentally at a young age the opportunity to feel that magic, that power to know that I affected someone else's life. Some people don't get that experience until maybe they're older and it's kind of too late to guide their life on that passion. But with Team Kids, the kids learn that early and they get kind of addicted to this feeling of creating change and helping others. And it becomes a lifelong path.
I think that we all as human beings, whether we're adults or children, one of the biggest things that we have a passion for is making an impact. You know, we want to look back at the end of our lives and feel like the work that we did had a positive impact on people, and to give these kids, these, you know, kindergarten through sixth graders, that opportunity. It's amazing to me to think. I mean, I think back, I lived a good childhood. I grew up in an upper middle class neighborhood in Fullerton with parents that provided every opportunity for me that I ever wanted, and probably some I didn't. But, you know, I don't think I ever, I can't recall any programs in my school. You know, I was in elementary school in the 60s and 70s. It's been a minute, but, you know, I don't recall any programs where I was taught how to lead or taught to work in a small group or taught to problem solve or create a business or philanthropic efforts. I mean, heck, these are terms that came into my life in the last decade, let alone when I was, you know, 8 years old. So kudos to you and the organization for this. It's just, it's amazing to me to think about the impact that's happening around the world. And I think even though you said you'd like to have a bigger footprint than just, you know, the states you're in or America, you do, because we're such a global economy. I mean, our world, kids that were educated here are now making a difference in their home countries, and whether they're physically there or they're passing it on. So you are, Team Kids is more of a global organization than you probably realize. What do you love most about this work? If you had to like pin it down to just a few things that you just, because I know you love it. I'm around you almost daily, whether it's a text message or a meeting or a board meeting or a community event. Julie was just honored last week by the Irvine Chamber, Greater Irvine Chamber in California, with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Women of Influence Awards. And it's funny because I think I sent you a text saying, hey, just because you just got a Lifetime Achievement Award doesn't mean your work is done. You're just getting started, my friend.
But
that's the type of impact, and you don't need to talk about that award because I know you're humble enough that you probably don't want to talk about it, but just so our viewers and listeners understand the impact that you're having. But back to my question, what do you love most about the work that you get to do through Team Kids?
Yeah, it's just that aha moment of like, I can create an influence greater than maybe what I previously thought. So our kids, certainly, I see it on everybody we work with. Our kids, when they come and they're kind of shy and, you know, they're on the leadership team and they see other kids who, you know, maybe they're the basketball players that are, you know, they don't know or they wouldn't hang with, and then they're all on one team and you see kids start talking about their businesses and wow, we could really make a difference. And when you see them at the carnival, they're so proud of the businesses they start. They're so proud and they're so kind to the younger kids and the police and fire, but you can see this confidence that they can do something so much more powerful than maybe they thought or what other people thought. And I just can't let it stop there, because we also have people, we had a teacher who was Teacher of the Year in Irvine who came up at a carnival and she had tears in her eyes to apologize to me. And she said, I was one of the teachers that didn't think the kids could do this. These are my kids that are hosting businesses to raise money for Chalk Hospital. And she retired and said, well, she told me it changed the whole way she teaches kids. She's like, I don't teach at kids. I realize how powerful they are. Yeah. And that same aha moment on a police officer who might come, show up and be like, you know, I know what to do. Don't say, you know, don't do drugs, don't join gangs. And we have to walk them back and say, you know what is crazy? We actually never say that. We are inviting them to be part of, you know, the team to do great things rather than talk about the bad things. And, yeah. And after the, you know, some of them are kind of awkward or kind of nervous, and then they get on stage and we can't get them off because they are so excited to remember why they went into service, to know that they could inspire these kids and they could be friends with them. And, you know, that goes a lot into our police research, but like, it's just that aha moment that it's like, here's my job and here's my job description. And then this ability to be like, wow, I can add this in and I can make a big difference in kids' lives and lower high risk behavior and a lot of other things. But it's that just spark of like, I'm powerful and I'm strong and people believe in me. And again, us adults experience that as well, because like I said, I think adults that witness this go back and are like, you know, I can up the ante and even be a better person. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of kids in this world who look at the police as the enemy. And there's a lot of police in this world that look at kids as the enemy because they see so many hard things. And I can't even imagine, you know, living in one of those communities where those that are out here to protect and to service are looked at the way they are. But a lot of things have happened that, you know, the few in any situation, the few ruin it for the many. A few bad eggs, you know, can make it so it's hard for people. So I'm always just really inspired when I see through Team Kids in any organization, but Team Kids in particular, where that bridge is being crossed and these kids and these police officers and firemen and military and teachers and business women and men are coming together with these kids and working together. And it's just, it's really a beautiful thing because you're creating, you personally and you Team Kids are creating an environment where I think that big word is trust. That trust is developed between generations, between those that are, you know, kids are looking at police a little bit differently because of their experience. When you're shooting hoops with and playing carnival games with and problem solving with a police officer in uniform, and you're this young kid who might have been taught by your parents that, hey, don't talk to that guy. He's not here to protect you like you think he is. It's pretty cool to see that come together.
It's exciting. That's really come out in our research. You know, we teach in cities that have a historical, you know, really negative situation with police, and deservingly so. You know, Compton, like the history, if you look at the history in Compton with law enforcement, and in New York City, and, you know, I always tell people, I'm not blindly pro-police. I think there are issues that need to be addressed, sure. But it's that saying, we're never going to change the problem by doing the same thing we've been doing. And right. So you nailed it when you say trust. I always say, like, our kids need trust caring adults in their lives. And the interaction with police and our research shows, not only does it help with police legitimacy and relationships between kids and police, but it changes the way police view kids. And so as powerful and as partners, and I have so many stories between kids and police that have been really eye-opening, like with Lorraine Maron in New York City. We need to get to know each other. It's like, yep, the cops, the homeless, yeah, the, no, we're all human beings. And yeah.
Stop labeling and start looking at us as a society, as a human race.
Yep. Yep. And I think, you know, it's just really, really critical. It's really critical in our world to address some of these issues. And the bigger issues, you know, those are being dealt with at a different level, but really our role is just, how do we have police officers and young people get to know each other at an earlier age so that everyone can have the relationships to feel safe in their community? And so, you know, so many stories about police and kids and how Team Kids has bridged a really powerful gap. And so that research, amongst other research, you know, well, maybe you'll ask later about our research, but it's really exciting to see what's happening on the front line.
I do want to go there, and I want to be mindful of time, and we may break this up into a couple of interviews because there's so much to talk about. Maybe we record for a little while and I do a couple episodes here because I don't want to cut it short, but I want to step back away from Team Kids just for a moment. Think 2021 comes along. You had your 20th anniversary. You've had impact galore, so many great things going on. Later, either that year or early 2022, your life gets turned upside down, for lack of a better way to put it. Talk about that process of your your diagnosis and what happened, and walk us through that. And then, as you have shared at a podium and in meetings and on other podcasts, probably where I've heard you share, the bridge will cross after you share the story a little bit, is what that lesson has taught you. Because if I know you well enough, I don't think you would go back 2 or 3 years and say, I don't want that to have happened to me, because of what I've seen you be able to do with that trial. So talk about that health trial that happened, and just walk us through that.
Yeah. So things in my life were busy, but really looking up. COVID was over. Our programs were back in schools. My family, we have 5 kids growing up and 3 grandkids, and life just felt full. It felt like I was just streaming along, you know, running fast, but kind of had control of what was going on. And I had some health issues, mostly with my shoulder. I was actually training for a half Ironman with my board president at the time, and was really just experiencing fatigue. And then I told my husband, I was like feeling like I couldn't really hear out of my right ear. And so I was at the doctor actually for a shoulder injury. And as he was leaving, he said, you know, any other questions? And I told him, I said, you know, I feel like I can't hear out of my right ear. And so he took a look, because sometimes you just have to have your ear cleaned out. And it's like, it looks clean. He said, we'll send you for a brain MRI, and don't even worry about it. He's like, it's 1 in 100,000 chance it could be something really serious. So, you know, get your MRI, we just rule it out. And I was like, oh my God, that sounds scary. So I'm like, yeah, okay, right away, 1 in 100,000. I've always been the one that gets the good luck odds, you know? So I figured I'm going to
go buy a lottery ticket. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I went for my MRI, and then a little while later, I got a call from my neurologist and said that, you know, he needed to talk to me about findings on my brain MRI, which isn't good news, because you want basically anytime you have a brain MRI, unremarkable. That's the best, like unremarkable. Yeah. You want. And I just could feel my stomach like just drop. And I was like, okay. He's like, I want you to come in tomorrow, which it took like a while to get in with him. And I was like, okay, so like, should I bring my husband? And then there was just quiet moment. And then they're like, yeah, your husband could come. And it was so scary. Yeah,
they're not calling you in with your husband to say, everything's great. Just wanted you to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're talking about your brain too. So, you know, it's not like a limb or something. And
right.
And that night it was just so scary. And so I went back in the next day, and he put the MRI up there, and I think a kindergartner could have diagnosed me. If one of your grandsons would have been like, why is there white thing on that side of not on the other? And it was just, I remember time stopping and just thinking about my own mortality, you know, and like, I have so much more to do, you know, and my kids who we just love, our grown kids and our grandkids. And it just, we always think I'm going to do this after that, and we have so much time, you know, and suddenly you think time is finite. Like any of this, something like this could happen to any of us. And then I heard the most beautiful words, and he said, it's the good kind of brain tumor, which again, I think brain tumor is good, but it was benign. It's a benign, very rare, slow growing tumor. So brain cancer is really terminal. So I did not have brain cancer. So he told me I wasn't going to die most likely. So I kind of grabbed on. I'm a forever optimist. So I'm like, okay, right. I'm not going to die. And because my tumor was so slow growing, I actually didn't have my surgery for 3 months so that I could get in with the very best surgeons in the world, which were here at UC San Diego. So it was a long 3 months of my faith, really contemplating my life. 3 months is a long time to wait to have a brain surgery. Just wonder what my life would be like. You know, I could have been paralyzed. I mean, I could have died. Just a lot of things. And so going into that surgery, that whole period of time was just such an incredible journey in my personal faith. And my surgery, I had a 7-hour surgery with 2 brain surgeons to get my tumor out, which was right by my brainstem. And you know, it was a really humbling 4 months of someone who I'm used to taking care of other people. Right. I had to learn to walk again. I wasn't allowed to walk up the stairs, even with rails. I couldn't shower by myself. I had to learn to write again because there was some challenge between the right side of my brain. And the bottom line is I do have some deficits. I permanently lost my hearing on the right side, as well as my whole vestibular system. So that's your balance on one side of your brain, and kind of tells your body where you fit in the world of, gosh, that's sure. thunder. It's kind of ominous.
I know, really. Right, we're in Southern California. We're getting rain, lightning, and thunder outside of both of our houses right now.
But I'm so lucky, and I've shared with you that, of course, I wish I didn't have a brain tumor, but I like who I am today better than before.
Right.
I'm a better person because of this journey, and I have a whole outlook on my life that I have as a second chance. I'm tumor-free, and aside from a few deficits, it shouldn't affect the rest of my life. But I find beauty everywhere. I'm present in things because I know that you don't wait a few months to find beauty in something when it's right in front of you. And just grateful to be alive and grateful to do this work and so grateful for my friends and my family. And, you know, I don't get upset about a lot of things. I used to put so much pressure on myself and should have got more done, or why didn't I do this? And now I'm really patient with myself and know how precious every day is. And so again, I don't know that I want to do it again. It was a pretty rough road, but I definitely see the gifts that have really changed my life forever.
What surprised you the most, if anything, and whether it's about yourself, about the process, about just these last couple of years, what has anything surprised you?
It's all surprising. I mean, I think, I just think I was someone who managed to juggle a lot. And I could always, back to those athlete roots, like I could always rise to the occasion. If it was public speaking or like a big event, you know, I would always find a way to make it work, you know? And I think what surprised me the most is that I don't have to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
I can focus on the things that matter most, and I can take care of myself. And so I wouldn't think that I'd be able to sometimes manage my energy, because that's one thing that is different neurologically. Not being able to hear and lights and sounds as I get more fatigued, and that I'm all right with that.
I met you right before your surgery. I remember when Jenny Denon and I, or she introduced me to you, and the three of us had breakfast together somewhere down in Irvine. And so I don't know the pre-surgery Julie very well, other than what you've shared and what Ray has shared and others have shared, and I've heard over the last few years. But my observation of you, and you've shared this a little bit already in this conversation, is that you've become, and I think this is common with a lot of people who go through either a traumatic diagnosis or a near-death experience or something where, you know, your priorities shift. Just that happens. You realize that, you know, there's so many things that we focus on in our lives that, yeah, they matter. To say it doesn't matter isn't accurate. But that we rechannel our energy and our efforts onto those bigger rocks, if you will. I love the analogy that Stephen Covey gave in his book, First Things First, on time management, where he has this big bucket. You've probably seen this.
Oh, yeah.
He has the big bucket of sand and then pebbles and then rocks. And, you know, they have to put those rocks represent the big important things in life. And if you try to, you know, pour the sand and the pebbles, which represent the lesser important things into the bucket, those rocks will never fit. But if you put the big rocks in the bucket first, which is all those important things, your grandkids, your spouse, your faith, you know, your family and things like that, then all the pebbles of career and all these other things and the sand, it all fits somehow. So I've seen in you that there seems to be, I love when, and I joked about this at the beginning of the podcast. I mean, this is an episode that would have been, like I said, it's number 97. It would have been in the 80s probably, but you and I both have had higher priority things come up that just, you know, sometimes it's health related. Sometimes it's one of our grandkids needs us. Sometimes something with a spouse or a friend or even on our job. And, you know, we love and respect each other enough, you and I, that we knew we were going to do this eventually. Yeah. And there was no rush, but we also didn't let the things that don't matter most get in the way of the things that do. And I think that's what I see in you is the little things don't get in the way of the big things now.
You know, and I totally agree with that. And I think, you know, we both share the same faith, you know, and that's been something that's been such a journey. I feel like I was so busy before, even before my brain surgery. I was having lunch with a dear friend and I actually told him, I said, I don't really have time for my faith anymore. I'm busy. I don't have time to pray. And I grew up Catholic and we, you know, we'd go to church, but I always have had faith. But I actually said that out loud, you know, I'm just too busy. And 3 days later, I was diagnosed with my brain tumor. And I called this friend and I said, I just need to see you. And I was just crying. And I said, I just told you that. And this is what now I have a brain tumor. I don't even know how to pray now because like, I feel so selfish, you know, like, and by the way, remember me, like I have a brain tumor and like help me. And it just felt so, but the journey through those 3 months, when you talked about those big rocks, that's what I was thinking, you know, it was like, maybe I should find time for the things that really fill me up. And I think the journey into that surgery, because in order to take the tumor out, they actually had to take out a size of my skull about this big. It was intracranial brain surgery. So they had to take out a big piece of my skull and then staple it all back together. And so it takes some faith, not only God, but in like human beings to do that. And I went from, you know, right before I got diagnosed to saying like, I don't really have that much time for my faith to this is what's going to get me through. And in fact, just some amazing experiences that I had through that to know that, you know, my work on this earth, weren't, God wasn't done with me yet, you know, and I just respect everyone's faith or the, you know, the environment. People have so many different ways of having hope for the future.
Right.
But it really pulled me in and feel really blessed about that.
Yeah, I had this conversation with somebody the other day. I can't remember if it was on a podcast or just in a conversation, but whether you're a believer in God or you're just a believer in some higher power, always focus on finding, the person was asking me, you know, what's my philosophy in life? And I think it was a podcast conversation now that I think about it. A lot of us try to find God in other people, but if you're, you know, whatever your belief system is, just find good in other people. It's just add an O to the word, you know, it's God, G-O-D or good, G-O-O-D, but try to find good in people and also live your life so that people can find good in you. You know, those are driving forces for most of the people I hang out with, you know, the little circle of friends that you and I share, that little group text that we're on every day where we're constantly celebrating good things happening to our friends or for our friends or the good things that they're doing in the community. And be careful. The message to those that are watching and listening today is don't ever say you don't have time for your faith, because you don't want to have the same things happen to you that happened to Julie 3 days later. But I
just want to say too, like, I know people that don't, you know, don't have a religious faith, but they're so connected to the environment, nature. And I just respect all religions and faith that call us to be better people or humanist or environment, you know, what fills you up that gives you hope to be the best person to be, because I think that's how we all come together, you know, for good.
Was there ever a time when you almost called it quits on Team Kids, going back in the 23 year history, where you almost just said, you know what, it's too much?
There were a few, and one was really tough, because it was right after, it was about a year after the kids saved Jeremy's life, and they kept going, you know, they kept growing and serving and doing amazing work. And we had a free office that was donated to us that we lost. And, you know, the first 2 or 3 years of Team Kids, I didn't make a penny as a salary. You know, my husband and I talk about faith. I mean, probably cost us about $10,000 a year for me to work for free, instead of having a job. So it's like a double negative. And we had lost that job, that office. And I just was tired. I was tired trying to figure out how to do this as an entrepreneur, because I'm really an entrepreneur. It's just, instead of raising money, I'm changing lives. I'm an entrepreneur.
You've made the better choice.
And so I was really thinking, this was probably 2024, maybe. I just needed to either just be home with my family or do another job. I just felt really overwhelmed. And I actually had lunch with my good friend, Jeff Hetchel, who's actually a chaplain. And I don't complain a lot. I'm not a crier. It's the athlete of me, right? You get up, you do the job. But Jeff Hetchel is trained to be very compassionate. And so we were at Strawberry Farms and he was like, how are you doing? And I just started crying. And I said, I don't know how if I can do this. And we don't have money and we don't have an office. And he was so kind. He was like, oh, Julie, this is, oh man, this is so hard. Oh yeah. Man. When you're upset and someone's so kind to you, it just opens the floodgates. So I was just crying. And then he looked at me and he goes, are you done now?
Your party's over?
Yeah. And he's like, I'm going to tell you why there's no way in hell you're quitting. And he asked me, he said, if you quit, who would it be most difficult to say it was going away? And then I started crying again. And I said, our founding kids, because you know what? This mission is created for them to know that they matter. And I have to tell them, they actually don't matter. Nobody wants to give money to you. Yeah. Nobody cares about Teen Kids or Kids Helping Kids. And so I always said there was never an exit strategy. There's no way I step out, because it's basically saying kids don't actually matter.
Right.
And so it's really good things happened, actually. Just like the week after that, we got a call from a retired cardiologist in Newport Beach and said, I don't really know what you're doing, but I know you need an office and your work is too important to go away. And he donated. We had a free office in Fashion Island area right next to the Newport Beach Athletic Club. And shortly after that, we connected with our first big donor, Kelly Smith, who donated $200,000 to Teen Kids. And that all happened within just a few weeks of me
almost ready to hang it up.
Teen Kids cleats, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the analogy I was thinking of as well. Well, I'm glad that you had that conversation with him and that he let you have your little pity party and then called you out of it, because none of us would be where we are today if Team Kids wasn't around, because you've made an impact on not only the kids that you've served and the board members that I obviously luckily get to be a part of, but just the impact on these police officers and these firefighters and these teachers. And this friend of mine who's a teacher in the Fullerton School District who's been impacted by Team Kids, and you know, whether or not you've ever met her, you've made an impact on her, and the program has as well. Team Kids does a lot of things to try to raise the bar for kids. And sometimes raising the bar requires raising some funds like any nonprofit. Talk about one of those programs that we're having fun with now, this Team Kids Lemonade Project.
Yeah, so we're launching a Team Kids social enterprise. Actually, we have launched a soft launch, and it's a kind of, it looks like a Suja bottle, but it's a pure, fresh lemonade. And it's really important, because one of Team Kids' other projects is called Team Kids Lemonade, that we started with Katrina, where we invite kids to host lemonade stands after natural disasters. So kids across the nation have raised over $100,000, one sticky quarter at a time, we say. And so I've always wanted to have a lemonade that would fund our programs. And so met Jeff Roberts, who's the owner of Sergeant Pepperoni's, about a year ago. And I said, I always wish we had a lemonade. And he said, let's do it. And so we have a pure organic lemonade. It's just water, lemonade, or lemon juice, and pure organic agave. And so we're just launching it, really creating a business plan and looking for partners in restaurants and businesses and stores. The beauty of it is the lemonade actually has a QR code. So kids can click the QR code and it actually takes them to a site for them to spread kindness in their community, whether it's helping animals or the environment. And the revenue of that product actually goes directly to support our mission. 100% of the revenue goes back to the programs to support the kids in their community. And so super excited about that. And I think we're going to have a lot of trajectory of growth. And, you know, it gives us the ability to fuel our mission without always having to write grants and have that autonomy to raise funds to reach more kids. So it's really exciting and it's delicious.
What is Team Kids Lemonade, right? We just had a meeting Friday, but I'll let you go ahead and share for those that are hearing about this for the first time and that may have access to distribution or manufacturing or restaurants or grocery stores or places where they may be interested in learning more. What needs do we have on the lemonade side of things right now?
Gosh, you know, really on the advertising and marketing, our production, it's currently a fresh pressed lemonade. So we're also looking at maybe an aseptic packaging to extend the life or the shelf life. But mostly it's just people who own a pizza restaurant or a chain of restaurants or a grocery store. I think right now securing even a handful of those partners that are willing to bring Team Kids Lemonade into their establishment to help support kids, that will put Team Kids on the map, because it drives distribution and production. And even, you know, we teach in New York City with NYPD. So they're talking there about how they can get Teen Kids Lemonade with the NYPD logo for their youth programs. Just people that have experience in distribution and the beverage, food and beverage world, to help us really launch this product so that funds can be raised, so that every child in every school in this nation has an opportunity to meet heroes, meet real heroes in their school, and be asked to, if they could join the kids to be part of making a difference. And that's the vision, is really Teen Kids. You probably remember DARE when you were young.
Yep.
Teen Kids Absolutely. Should be DARE in this country, so that children actually, and it's not just fifth grade, kindergarten all the way through sixth or eighth grade, are part of a program where their dreams of purpose matter, where they have opportunities to actually feel like what it feels like to be a leader and know people count on them. And, you know, all those, that capacity exists in every one of our communities to do that. And so Teen Kids Lemonade is a great driver in helping us get the capacity to expand to empower more kids.
So I'll further the commercial a little bit here. If you are that person and you're watching or listening today, and you have any of these, if it touches your heart, or you have any of these connections or these resources or ideas, I mean, it doesn't even have to be that you reach out to us with a solution, but hey, I got a question, or I have an idea about this. How do they reach you so they can share that idea and those questions with you?
Absolutely.
Or anything about Team Kids in general, best way to reach you.
Easy way to learn more about Teen Kids is teamkids.org. You can even read the research on our program and how it's strengthening protective factors to lower high-risk behavior and increasing thriving factors. That research is on our website. It's in the American Psychological Association Journal, three other top academic journals. So we know this program is changing lives of kids. And then my email is jhudash@teamkids.org. So I'm sure you'll share that. And if you forget that, you can reach me just at info@teamkids.org. And I always have to say it's TEAMKIDS. Sometimes people think it's teen, like TEEM. Yeah, yeah.
Join the team.
You can also get a hold of Ed, because he's on our board and our fund development and marketing chair. So you might hear from him either way.
Yeah, this is definitely a 1 hour. It's not meant to be a 1 hour commercial for Teen Kids, and it's not. But, you know, anytime like I said, you're episode 97, and I've interviewed a lot of really just amazing people over the last few years, never with the intent that it's a commercial for that person or their organization. But, you know, people are doing some tremendous things in this world. Those of you listening are doing tremendous things. Julie is the previous guest I've had. I like to think I'm doing a few things too. I mean, we wake up in the morning and we go out and we intermingle with people, we're making a difference, because it might be that smile that you gave to that barista at your local coffee place, or the conversation you had with the person next to you while you're pumping gas, you could have changed their, or even saved their lives. You don't know. You don't know what they were on their way to go do, whether it was good, bad, or indifferent, but the impact that we can have on people, and to see the work that you're doing, Julie, with Team Kids, and to see these kids, and to see, I love that we see kids now on your staff and in your board that were kids that went through the program, and to see where they are today, just, it really, really touches me. You touched on the research a little bit, and you alluded to it earlier in the conversation. Is there anything further on the research that you'd like to share?
I just to share that, you know, that research stemmed from a full scientific randomized control trial in partnership with Compton Unified, and was done by Arizona State University Criminology Department. And it took a lot of capacity for Teen Kids at a time where we were growing to really slow down and invest in that level of national research. And I think the part that I would want to share the most is when we started that research, we weren't dealing with the pediatric mental health crisis that we are today. That was definitely going on. But today, you know, we have unprecedented mental health crisis. One in six kids aged 2 to 8 are diagnosed with a mental illness. We have kids, 22% of adolescents today consider suicide. This was not the case several years ago. And so I feel like our work ever since Jeremy it's always been important for all the right reasons. But today specifically, it's an emergency situation for kids today. And the COVID, you know, the pandemic made it hard, but I would like to think that, you know, the emergency situation that's facing kids today, that Teen Kids is a little piece of the emergency solution and response, you know, training police and firefighters to be in schools to help kids feel safe and valued and feel hopeful about their future. When you asked me about a specific child, you know, that this Teen Kids made a difference on, it suddenly made me think that, like, I could picture a lot of faces and a lot of stories. And actually, it would be a wonderful podcast to just tell these great stories.
Yeah.
But so often today, you know, there's so many children who maybe they're not suffering from a physiological depression or a chemical, you know, issue that they really need to have clinical support and mental health. So many of our kids just are sad. They're disconnected. They're lonely.
Yeah.
They don't feel hopeful for their future. And so to me, I feel like Teen Kids is an example, and Teen Kids isn't going to change everything. We're just a piece of the puzzle, but I think we're a critical piece, you know, along with Boys and Girls Clubs and all of the other organizations I'm lucky to serve alongside. But like, it's a response to help kids feel good about themselves. And when we talk about 1 in 6 children, ages 2 to 8, 1 in 6, you know, diagnosed with mental illness, a lot of those kids just need to feel loved and hopeful and feel like they fit in. And so I feel like Teen Kids is one of those programs that can keep so many kids from tipping into or off the cliff into needing clinical mental health support, because so many of them just need to feel good about who they are and feel valued. And so that's what I would say with the research that means the most to me is our world has changed a lot for young people. And that's what I'm most proud of.
Yeah, I love, I'm sure this is probably the fourth straight podcast where I've shared what I'm about to share, but it's, I'm such an advocate that, I mean, there's a lot of things. I jotted down, what do kids need? And you were answering it as I was writing it down. And then I answered, you know, you answered from your perspective. And I've researched a little and read a lot over the years about what do people need in general. But I think about those kids in particular. They need to, we as people, but kids in particular, I believe, need to feel like they belong to something bigger than themselves.
Yes.
Where they can make an impact. They need to have a responsibility in that area. Someone's relying on them to do something, and they need a friend. And it sounds like what you're doing is giving them this, I'm part of something much bigger than I am. You know, Team Kids, these programs, these carnivals, these opportunities to raise $200 to $3,000, as you talked about earlier, for, you know, saving koala bears or saving cancer or stopping rape, you know, whatever it is that their cause is that they believe in, that they are in that because it's bigger than they are, that they have a responsibility. What's my job today to do something about it? And then they have a friend that they can serve alongside. And that's that accountability partner, if you will. And from your 23 years of doing this, from raising 5 amazing kids, I think I know them all. I know at least 4 of them, to now being a grandma, to playing a part in raising 250,000 kids in your work. What do kids really need from your perspective? You've already answered a lot of it, and I've touched on it too, but just when you go back to, you know, your little circle of your kids, your grandkids, the community, the 250,000 kids that have gone through the program to date, what do you see that is the biggest need?
Heroes. They need to meet heroes, and it's, you know, regardless of the demographic, you know, that kids are growing up in, there's so much power in a child having an adult who cares about their future, who isn't their parent. Because in all perfect worlds, and many of our kids are in foster care, or, you know, not all of them have parents at home. When an adult takes an interest in you and your well-being, and you're not your parents or your grandma, it is research shows it creates so much growth. It's that teacher that says, you're a great reader. You know what? You're really smart. And people often say it was that one coach. It was that one teacher. And so kids need heroes who see their potential and show up, not because they want to tell them not to do drugs or want something from them other than, you know, to be the person that they're capable of being. And I think all of our kids come with creative dreams and want to live a life of purpose. You know, we teach in East New York, Brooklyn, East Harlem. We teach in Bushwick in Brooklyn. They're the most polite, amazing kids. Now, they're some of the most high-risk areas. NYPD searches risk ranks their 150 precincts based on violence and where there's the most gang activity. And one of our schools is in number 4.
Wow.
And these kids are so incredible. They're so so excited to have people believe in them, and what it's just transformative for them, you know? And so regardless of what kind of community that you're in, it's our kids need heroes. And, but again, in those communities, kids don't, if you say, what do you want to be when you grow up? None of those kids want to be in gangs. We fail those kids because we don't give them reasons and opportunities and hope that they can be other things. So it's almost criminal what happens in so many communities where kids don't have the exposure and the opportunity and the mentors to know that they can make those things happen. Because having worked with kids in so many different communities, our kids are equally brilliant. They're equally creative. No one program, no child in any community is better than any other child, but there's just such an inequity of kids who have exposure to opportunities and new ideas and mentors and opportunities to try something new and see themselves in a different way. And so I think Team Kids, you know, that's a big part. In our schools, we're in a school in East Harlem, and it's English, Spanish. It's a bilingual, bicultural school. We have 2 to 4 NYPD officers at every leadership team, and they're all bilingual. So NYPD makes sure those officers can speak Spanish, so every child is part of that. Well, what does that tell you if you're at a school, you're 8 years old and you only speak Spanish, and up there on the stage is an NYPD police officer with a badge and a gun speaking Spanish to you about how powerful you are and how excited they are to be on your team? So, you know, I think we can all, with all those dreams of kids, I think we can bet on our kids. I think it's time to, you know, invest in betting on the future of our kids.
What big goals for Team Kids? What do you envision 5 years, 10 years down the road before you go, like you talked about hanging the cleats up, before you hang up the cleats, what do you want to see happen?
Yeah. So we're just at such a powerful time right now because the research, really, we did the research to know we'd be able to sit at the table for like a large federal grant. We got our first Department of Justice grant with Phoenix PD. So we have a big expansion going on in Phoenix. And my goal over the next 5 years is to leverage our research, which is now empirically validated and really critical. I spent time with Deputy Commissioner Chauncey Parker at NYPD, just to kind of give you, I don't know if anybody here watches Blue Bloods, but Tom Selleck is the commissioner.
Commissioner, right.
I spent time with the deputy commissioner over all collaborative policing with NYPD. And he used to be a state attorney. And he said, Julie, no one has the research you have. Like, you have full support of collaborative policing with NYPD. Okay, that's 35,000 sworn officers, the biggest police department in the world. So my dream is to be able to leverage, you know, federal grants, Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Ed, Office of like Juvenile Justice and Delinquency. Let's take this research that we know the program's helping kids feel more positive about themselves and more connected to their community and increasing self-efficacy and empathy and building strong relationships with police. And let's take that research and secure federal grants so that this program can happen in any city where there's a school and a police department. And it sounds overwhelming, but it's mostly just tying the loose ends of each school is contracted with a local law department. So I always say, like, you know, the kids in Compton, the police in Compton, they don't need to worry about the kids in Irvine because that's Irvine PD's kids or the kids in Brooklyn.
Has them covered.
They're all there. All those resources are there. And I would just close this remark with, I think there's a lot of conversation of not having enough capacity. I don't feel that at all. There's plenty of capacity out there and resources. It's just, how do we align them so that our police, our teachers, our businesses who sponsor our programs, that we're all doing a better job in an innovative way to collaboratively make a difference on kids that's so much stronger than any one of us can have. So, you know, I don't think the needs are so great that I don't think any one agency has the privilege of saying, my job is just doing this. Nope, sorry, you got to do that. And you got to figure out how to work with everybody else that is working with kids and do something different than we've ever done, because that's how emergent the issues are with kids. And so my hope is 5 years from now, you know, we have a very large federal grant with agencies all working together, and that Team Kids, every police department and school, they want to be a Team Kids school, or, you know, they're proud to be a Team Kids police officer or city. And they're using their resources to invest in kids.
Get a Team Kids sticker on every police car in America, put in their window, right? People know they're part of Team Kids, that they're there for the kids.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm going to end this interview the way I started it. I'm going to read one more time from your bio, the last sentence. And this is Julie's words. I believe it's our most privileged responsibility to ensure that our future leaders, these kids we're talking about today, social entrepreneurs and philanthropists, have the support, experiences, and mentors they need to make their biggest dreams come true. Talk to that person who wants to become a mentor to a child. What advice, and how do they start?
You know, I would say start small. You know, I think, how can you impact kids where you already are? You know, kids you already see on your neighborhood. If you have a little kid down the street who plays Little League baseball, don't just go in your garage and shut the door. Mm. Hey, did you have a game? How'd your game go? You know, I was really excited to hear. How did you make it? You know, did you make a hit or whatever? Kids that are selling lemonade, like, don't ever drive past a lemonade stand. You know?
Right.
But I think if you can get involved, if you want to get involved, you know, there are amazing ways. I mean, Big Brothers Big Sisters, certainly with Team Kids. If you have a business and you want your company to be involved in a big way, you know, Team Kids has a wonderful way to sponsor a school and have your employees actually part of delivering the Team Kids Challenge with our staff and our police and our firefighters. But I really think that we can make a big difference just by showing up and for the kids that are already in our lives, that are already in our neighborhood. You know, take time. Just don't, if you see teenagers in a community, don't lock your door. Chances are that kid that looks like a rough kid is probably like the kid doing great things you'd wish your kids do. But we send messages to kids that say they don't matter. And so I think that's the biggest way, honestly, because we all touch the lives of so many kids, and you can be an asset builder just in how, you know, we always ask kids, you know, what do you want to be? They don't know, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't tell kids they're beautiful, you know. Ask, like, what kind of person do you want to be when you grow up?
Just engage. Who do you want to be? Engage with them. There's a great, great country western song, and I'm not a singer, but Brooks and Dunn did a song called Believe. And it's a song about this, you know, this young man in college now singing about back when he would, you know, his mom would send him over to, you know, old man's house. I can't remember his name, to, you know, borrow a cup of sugar or what have you. And how this old man just took a love for this young man. And anyway, maybe I'll play the song on the podcast at the end, but it's a great song about the power of mentors and the power of, you know, just an older person engaging in the life of a young person and the impact that they can have. So
yeah, we can all have that impact. And again, I just say that we have never seen this level of emergency need for our kids today. These are our kids. You know, these are our future employee, you know, staff. It is a crisis. And so again, we all can play a role, whether it's, you know, mentoring through Team Kids or Boys and Girls Club or Big Brothers Big Sisters. Like, show up, because our kids, our young people today have just never faced the kind of emotional needs in any time in our history. And so, you know, again, if you're a business person, if you're a mentor, if you're a cop, if you're a firefighter, yeah, we don't get to just go on our way and just go to work, because I don't worry about kids because I run a bank, or well, you got to do that. And we all have to show up, you know, as heroes and be there for kids.
Yeah. Well, this is, we could turn the page and start a new chapter here, but for the sake of time, thank you for taking the time finally for us to sit down together and talk. And I feel like I've gotten to know you even better. I feel like I knew you pretty well before this conversation, but it's always a joy and a privilege for me to get a chance to talk with you, Julie. So love the work that you're doing. Love you, your family, and just the impact that you guys are all making. And I'm gonna close today with the same question that I've asked every guest that I've ever had. And it's, I always ask myself, should I still ask this question? Because you just spent an hour talking about it. But if I were to just put this question out there, how would you answer? Julie Hudash, what's in your heart?
Am I allowed two words?
You can say whatever you want. You can go two.
Gratitude for my life. And I would say, I hate to say impatience, but I feel the urgent need that's out there for young people. So I feel a little impatient about getting everybody lined up to show up for kids. So I guess it's kind of a maybe two sides of the same coin, but personally very grateful. But also, you know, I'm still on this planet today after a brain surgery and a brain tumor. And I want to see this change in my own life. And we can do this every community at a time, every child. And so there is a little bit of impatience. So people always say, do you look back and look at all you achieved? I'm like, yeah, not really. Because like, there's still so much to do. I don't have time to do. Not that I don't appreciate what we've done, but there's so much work to do.